Hi, this is Mrs. English again. I'm going to be reading to you from Homer's Odyssey. This is the Richmond Lattimore translation of Homer's Odyssey. And we are now in Book 11. Remember, as Book 11 opens, that we are continuing to tell the story to the Phaeacians. Odysseus is with the Phaeacians, and they are willing to stay up all night if they have to listen to this story. And so he continues to tell the Phaeacians. Now when we had gone down again to the sea and our vessel, first of all, we dragged the ship down into the bright water, and in the black hull set the mast in place, and set sails, and took the sheep and walked them aboard, and ourselves also embarked, but sorrowful, and weeping big tears. Circe of the lovely hair, the dread goddess who talks with mortals, sent us an excellent companion, a following wind, filling the sails to carry from astern the ship with the dark prow. We ourselves, over all the ship, making fast the running gear, line 10, sat still and let the wind and the steersman hold her steady. All day long her sails were filled as she went through the water and the sun set, and all the journeying ways were darkened. She made the limit, which is of the deep running ocean. There lie the community and city of Cimmerian people, hidden in fog and cloud, nor does Helios, the radiant sun, ever break through the dark to illuminate them with his shining. Neither when he climbs up into the starry heaven, nor when he wheels to return again from heaven to earth, but always a glum night is spread over wretched mortals. Making this point, we ran the ship ashore, and took out the sheep, and ourselves walked along by the stream of the ocean, until we came to that place of which Circe had spoken. As an interruption, remember, Odysseus is now telling the Phaeacians about a place where no one has been. No one they have ever met or seen has gone to the edge of the world. And Odysseus is telling them this. Back to line 23. There, Perimedes and Eurylochus held the victims fast, and I, drawing from beside my thigh the sharp sword, dug a pit of about a cubit in each direction, and poured it full of drink offerings for all the dead. First, honey mixed with milk, and the second pouring was sweet wine, and the third, water, and over it all I sprinkled white barley. Now, the idea of this is that the people in the underworld can eat and accept offerings. I promised many times to the strengthless heads of the perished dead, line 30, returning to Ithaca, I would slaughter a barren cow, my best, in my palace, and pile the pyre with treasures, and to Tiresias apart would dedicate an all-black ram, black because you sacrifice black animals to gods of the underworld, an all-black ram, the one conspicuous in all our sheep flocks. And now, when with sacrifices and prayers I had so entreated the hordes of the dead, I took the sheep and cut their throats over the pit, and the dark, clouding blood ran in, and the souls of the perished dead gathered to the place, up out of Erebus, out of the darkness. Brides and young unmarried men, and long-suffering elders, virgins, tender with the sorrows of young hearts upon them, and many fighting men killed in battle, stabbed with brazen spears, still carrying their bloody armor upon them. These came swarming around my pit from every direction with inhuman clamor, and green fear took hold of me. Then I encouraged my companions and told them, taking the sheep that were lying by, slaughtered with the pitiless bronze, to skin these and burn them and pray to the divinities, to Hades the powerful, and to revered Persephone, while I myself, drawing from beside my thigh my sharp sword, crouched there, and would not let the strengthless heads of the perished dead draw nearer to the blood until I had questioned Tiresias. Line 50. Here we have an image of Odysseus holding off the dead, all the dead heads who are, that's what he calls them, the strengthless heads of the perished dead, and they are trying to get to the blood so that they can become full of their senses again and have understanding for a while. And he's holding them all off with his sword because he's waiting to question Tiresias first. Line 51. But first, there came the soul of my companion, Elpenor, for he had not yet been buried under earth of the wide ways, since we had left his body behind in Circe's palace, unburied and unwept, with this other errand before us. I broke into tears at the sight of him, and my heart pitied him, and so I spoke aloud to him and addressed him in winged words. Elpenor, how did you come here beneath the fog and the darkness? You've come faster on foot than I could in my black ship. So I spoke, and he groaned aloud and spoke and answered. Line 60. Son of Laertes and seed of Zeus, resourceful Odysseus, and the evil will of the spirit and the wild wine bewildered me. I lay down on the roof of Circe's palace and never thought when I went down to go by way of the long ladder. Remember this from the Odyssey, just last book, Odyssey book 10, line 551. Elpenor fell asleep on the roof and fell off. Forgot to use the ladder. When I went down to go by way of the long ladder, a bit blundered straight off the edge of the roof, so that my neck bone was broken out of its sockets, and my soul went down to Hades. But now, I pray you, by those you have yet to see, who are not here, by your wife and by your father, who reared you when you were little, and by Telemachus, whom you left alone in your palace, for I know that after you leave this place and the house of Hades, you will put back with your well-made ship to the island, Aia, there at that time, my lord, I ask that you remember me, and do not go and leave me behind, unwept, unburied, when you leave, for fear I might become the god's curse upon you, but burn me there with all my armor that belongs to me, and heap up a grave mound beside the beach of the gray sea, for an unhappy man, so that those who come will know of me. Do this for me, and on top of the grave mound, plant the oar with which I rode when I was alive among my companions. This is a little unusual because Elpenor apparently can speak without drinking the blood, and I suppose it must be because his body isn't buried yet. Hard to say. Line 79. So he spoke, and I in turn spoke to him in answer. All this, my unhappy friend, I will do for you as you ask me. So we two stayed there, exchanging our sad words, I on one side holding my sword over the blood, while opposite me the phantom of my companion talked long with me. Next, there came to me the soul of my dead mother, Anticlea, daughter of great-hearted Autolycus, whom I had left alive when I went to sacred Ilion, to Troy. I broke into tears at the sight of her, and my heart pitied her. But even so, for all my thronging sorrow, I would not let her draw near the blood until I had questioned Tiresias. Line 90. Now came the soul of Tiresias the Theban, holding a staff of gold, and he knew who I was and spoke to me. Son of Laertes and seed of Zeus, resourceful Odysseus, how is it then, unhappy man, you have left the sunlight and come here to look on dead men and this place without pleasure? Now draw back from the pit, and hold your short, sharp sword away from me, so that I can drink of the blood and speak the truth to you. So he spoke, and I, holding away the sword with the silver nails, pushed it back in the sheath, and the flawless prophet, after he had drunk the blood, began speaking to me. Line 100. Glorious Odysseus, what you are after is sweet homecoming, but the god will make it hard for you. I think you will not escape the shaker of the earth, Poseidon, who holds a grudge against you in his heart, and because you blinded his dear son, Polyphemus the Cyclops, he hates you. But even so and still, you might come back after much suffering if you can contain your own desire and contain your companions at that time when you first put in your well-made vessel at the island Thrinikai, escaping the sea's blue water, and there discover pasturing the cattle and fat sheep of Helios, who sees all things and listens to all things. Line 110. Then, if you keep your mind on homecoming and leave these unharmed, you might all make your way to Ithaca after much suffering. But if you do harm them, these are the cattle of Helios, if he harms them, then I testify to the destruction of your ship and your companions. But if you get yourself clear, you will come home in bad case, with the loss of all your companions in someone else's ship, and find troubles in your household. Insolent men who are eating away your livelihood and courting your godlike wife and offering gifts to her. This, you remember, is a continuation of that curse that Polyphemus placed on Odysseus, since he knew his name, who to curse, and that was back in Book 9, line 534. Line 118. You may punish the violences of these men, the suitors, when you come home, But after you have killed these suitors in your own palace, either by treachery or openly with the sharp bronze, then you must take up your well-shaped oar and go on a journey until you come where there are men living who know nothing of the sea." These lines are fascinating because Tiresias is telling poor Odysseus here that even after he gets home, kills the suitors, takes care of his household, he has another journey to take. To see the men living who know nothing of the sea and who eat food that is not mixed with salt, who never have known ships whose cheeks are painted purple, who never have known well-shaped oars, which act for ships as wings do. And I will tell you a very clear proof, and you cannot miss it. When, as you walk, some other wayfarer happens to meet you and says you carry a winnow fan on your bright shoulder, then you must plant your well-shaped oar in the ground, because the person who doesn't even know what a ship is has mistaken the oar slung over his shoulder to be a winnow fan, something when you separate the grain and the chaff you'd blow it off with. You plant your well-shaped oar in the ground and render ceremonial sacrifice to the Lord Poseidon, one ram and one bull, and a mounter of sows, a boar pig, and make your way home again and render holy hecatombs to the immortal gods who hold the wide heaven, all of them in order. More messages from Tiresias, the blind seer, to poor Odysseus. He's supposed to go to a place where they don't know anything about the sea. That probably means that they don't know anything about worshiping Poseidon, god of the sea. And since Poseidon is the one punishing him and hating him, perhaps this is from Poseidon. And what does he have to do when he first runs into somebody with his oar over his shoulder and they say, "What are you doing with a winnowing fan on your shoulder?" He says it's an oar and he's going to make sacrifices to Poseidon. And so perhaps in this way, this was the idea in my Peter Jones commentary on the Odyssey anyway, perhaps this is Poseidon's way of forcing Odysseus to spread the worship of Poseidon to places where they don't always already show him worship. Interesting, could be. Back to line 134, and Tiresias' prophecy to Odysseus continues, and now he tells him about his death. "Death will come to you from the sea, in some altogether unwarlike way, and it will end you in the ebbing time of a sleek old age. Your people about you will be prosperous. All this is true that I tell you." So he spoke, but I in turn said to him in answer, "All this, Tiresias, surely must be as the gods spun it. But come now," line 140, "tell me this and give me an accurate answer. I see before me now the soul of my perished mother, but she sits beside the blood in silence, and has not yet deigned to look directly at her own son and speak a word to me. Tell me, Lord, what will make her know me and know my presence?" Line 145. So I spoke, and he at once said to me in answer, "Easily I will tell you and put it in your understanding. Any one of the perished dead you allow to come up to the blood will give you a true answer. But if you begrudge this to anyone, he will return to the place where he came from." So speaking, the soul of the Lord Tiresias went back into the house of Hades once he had uttered his prophecies, while I waited steadily where I was standing until my mother came and drank the dark, clouding blood. And at once she knew me, and full of lamentation, she spoke to me in winged words, "My child, how did you come here beneath the fog and the darkness, and still alive? All this is hard for the living to look on. For in between lie the great rivers and terrible waters that flow, the ocean first of all, which there is no means of crossing on foot, not unless one has a well-made ship. Are you come now to this place from Troy, with your ship and your companions, after wandering a long time? And have you not yet come to Ithaca, and there seen your wife in your palace?" So she spoke, and I in turn said to her in answer, "Mother, a duty brought me here to the house of Hades." Line 165. "I had to consult the soul of Tiresias, the Theban, for I have not yet been near Achaean country, nor ever set foot on our land, but all with suffering I have wandered since the first time I went along with great Agamemnon to Ilion, to Troy, land of good horses, and the battle against the Trojans. But come now, tell me this, and give me an accurate answer. What doom of death that lays men low has been your undoing? Was it a long sickness, or did Artemis of the Arrows come upon you with her painless shafts and destroy you? and tell me of my father and son whom I left behind. Is my inheritance still with them, or does some other man hold them now and thinks I will come no more? Tell me about the wife I married, what she wants, what she is thinking, and whether she stays fast by my son and guards everything, or if she has married the best man among the Achaeans. So I spoke, and my queenly mother answered me quickly. All too much with endearing heart she does wait for you, there in your own palace, and always with her the wretched nights and days also waste her away with weeping. No one yet holds your fine inheritance, but in freedom Telemachus administers your allotted lands and apportions the equal feasts, work that befits a man with authority to judge, for all call him in. Your father remains on the estate where he is and does not go to the city. There is no bed there, nor is there bed clothing, nor blankets, nor shining coverlets, but in the winter time he sleeps in the house where the thralls do, in the dirt next to the fire, and with foul clothing upon him. But when summer comes and the blossoming time of harvest, everywhere he has places to sleep on the ground, on fallen leaves in piles along the rising ground of his orchard, and there he lies grieving, and the sorrow grows big within him as he longs for your homecoming, and harsh old age is on him. And so it was with me also, and that was the reason I perished. Nor in my palace did the Lady of Arrows, well aiming, come upon me with her painless shafts and destroy me, nor was I visited by sickness, which, beyond other things, takes the life out of the body with hateful weakness. But, shining Odysseus, it was my longing for you, your cleverness and your gentle ways, that took the sweet spirit of life from me. So now Odysseus knows he killed his mother. She died longing for him, and his father is falling completely to pieces in longing for his homecoming. So she spoke, but I, pondering it in my heart, yet wished to take the soul of my dead mother in my arms. 3 times I started toward her, and my heart was urgent to hold her, and 3 times she fluttered out of my hands like a shadow or a dream, and the sorrow sharpened at the heart within me. And so I spoke to her and addressed her in winged words, saying, Mother, line 210, why will you not wait for me when I'm trying to hold you, so that even in Hades, with our arms embracing, we can both take the satisfaction of dismal mourning? Or are you nothing but an image that proud Persephone sent my way to make me grieve all the more for sorrow? So I spoke, and my queenly mother answered me quickly, Oh, my child, ill-fated beyond all other mortals, this is not Persephone, daughter of Zeus, beguiling you, but it is only what happens when they die to all mortals. The sinews no longer hold the flesh and bones together, and once the spirit has left the white bones, all the rest of the body is made subject to the fire's strong fury, but the soul flitters out like a dream and flies away. Therefore, you must strive back toward the light again with all speed, but remember these things for your wife, so you may tell her hereafter. So we two were conversing back and forth, and the women came to me. This is what has come to be known as the catalogue of women. One after another, a famous woman comes and stands before Odysseus. Line 226. They were sent my way by proud Persephone. These were all who had been the wives and daughters of princes, and now they gathered in swarms around the dark blood. I then thought about a way to question them, each by herself, and as I thought, this was the plan that seemed best to me. Drawing out the long-edged sword from beside my big thigh, I would not let them all drink the dark blood at the same time. So they waited and came to me in order, and each one told me about her origin, and I questioned all of them. Line 235. There first I saw Tyro, gloriously descended, and she told me she was the daughter of stately Salimnius, but said she was the wife of Cretheus, the son of Aeolus, and she was in love like with a river, the godlike Enipeus, fought by far the handsomest of all those rivers whose streams cross over the earth, and she used to haunt Enipeus's beautiful waters, taking his likeness, the god who circles the earth and shakes it, lay with her where the swirling river finds its outlet, and a sea-blue wave curved into a hill of water reared up about the two to hide the god and the mortal woman. And he broke her virgin zone and drifted asleep upon her. But when the god had finished with the act of love-making, he took her by the hand and spoke to her and named her, saying, Be happy, lady, in this love, and when the year passes, you will bear glorious children, for the couplings of the immortals are not without issue. You must look after them and raise them. Go home now and hold your peace and tell nobody my name, but I tell it to you. I am the earth-shaker Poseidon. So he spoke and dived back into the heaving water of the sea, but she conceived and bore Peleus and Neleus. And of course, Neleus is the father of Nestor. And both of these grew up to be strong henchmen of mighty Zeus. Peleus lived, rich in sheep flocks, in the wide spaces of Iolcus. Iolcus is where Jason set out to get the golden fleece, while the other was king in sandy Pylos, and you know Nestor is now the king of Pylos. But this queen among women bore the rest of her children to Cretheus, Aeson and Pheres. And of course, Cretheus is her mortal husband. So she bore to Poseidon, and then she bore to her mortal husband. And to her mortal husband, she had Aeson and Pheres and Amnithaon, delighting in horses. Line 260. After I saw her, Antiope, who was the daughter of Asopus, who claimed she also had lain in the embraces of Zeus and borne two sons to him, Amphion and Zethus. These first established the foundations of seven-gated Thebes and built the bulwarks, since without bulwarks they could not have lived for all their strength in Thebes of the wide spaces. And of course, as a side note, here in the Odyssey, you are just now being introduced to Thebes and to the characters of Oedipus and to the prophet Tiresias, but we will continue to meet these in later literature. So put these in your memory. Line 266. After her, I saw Amphitryon's wife, Alcmene, who, after lying in love in the embraces of great Zeus, who else, brought forth Heracles, lion-hearted and bold of purpose. And I saw Megara, daughter of high-spirited Creon, whom Amphitryon's bold and weariless son had married. I saw the beautiful Epicaste, Oedipus's mother. Of course, we call her Jocasta, Oedipus's mother, and we will learn all about her when we read Sophocles' tragedy, Oedipus Rex, who in the ignorance of her mind had done a monstrous thing when she married her own son. He killed his father and married her, but the gods soon made it all known to mortals. But he, for all his sorrows in beloved Thebes, continued to be lord over the Cadmeans. Cadmus was the first king of Thebes, and so they are the Cadmeans. All through the bitter designing of the gods, while she went down to Hades of the gates, the strong one, knotting a noose and hanging sheer from the high ceiling in the constraint of her sorrow, but left him who survived her all the sorrows that are brought to pass by a mother's furies. And of course, this entire little paragraph here is about Oedipus, who accidentally married his mother after killing his father, not knowing who it was. Line 281. And I saw Chloris, surpassingly lovely, the one whom Neleus married for her beauty, giving numberless gifts to win her. She was the youngest daughter of Iasus' son Amphion, who once ruled strongly over Ocomnius of the Minyae. So she was queen of Pylos, and she bore him glorious children, Nestor and Chromius and proud Periclymenus. Also she bore that marvel among mortals, majestic Pyrrho, whom all the heroes round about courted, but Neleus would not give her to any unless he could drive away the broad-faced, horn-curved cattle of strong Iphicles out of Phylace in Thessaly. It was hard to do, and only the blameless seer Melampus undertook it, but he was bound fast by the hard destiny of the god and the painful fetters on him and the loutish ox-herds. But when the months and the days had come to an end, and the year had gone full circle, and come back with the seasons returning, then strong Iphicles released him, when he had told him all the prophecies he knew, and the will of Zeus was accomplished. And I saw Leda, who had been the wife of Tyndareus, and she had borne to Tyndareus two sons with strong hearts, Castor, breaker of horses, and the strong boxer, Polydeuces. As a side note, you see these as Castor and Pollux, Castor with a K or a C, and Pollux, which is just the Latin form. These sons of Zeus, remember, Clytemnestra and Helen and Castor and Pollux, two were the sons of Leda's mortal husband Tyndareus, and two are the immortal children or demigods of Zeus. And together the brothers are known as the Dioscuri, the sons of Zeus. Line 301. The life-giving earth holds both of them, yet they are still living, and, even underneath the earth enjoying the honor of Zeus, they still live every other day. On the next day they are dead, but they are given honor even as gods are. These are the Dioscuri. They share their immortality. They take turns being immortal. Line 305. After her, I saw Iphimedea, wife of Eloeus, but she told me how she had been joined in love with Poseidon and borne two sons to him. But these, in the end, had not lived long. Otus, like a god, and the far-famed Ephialtes. And these were the tallest men the grain-giving earth has brought forth ever, and the handsomest by far, after famous Orion. When they were only 9 years old, they measured 9 cubits across. But in height, they grew to 9 fathoms, and even made threats against the immortal gods on Olympus, that they would carry the turmoil of battle with all its many sorrows against them, and were minded to pile Ossa on Olympus, and above Ossa, Pelion of the trembling leaves, to climb the sky. Surely they would have carried it out if they had come to maturity, but the son of Zeus, whom Leda, with ordered hair, had borne him, Apollo, killed them both, before ever the down gathered below their temples or on their chins the beards had blossomed. I saw Phaedra and Procris and Ariadne, the beautiful daughter of malignant Minos. Theseus at one time was bringing her from Crete to the high ground of sacred Athens, but got no joy of her, since before that Artemis killed her in sea-washed Dia, when Dionysius bore witness against her. Line 326. I saw Myra, Clymene, and Eurypyle the hateful, who accepted precious gold for the life of her own dear husband. But I could not tell over the whole number of them, nor name all the women I saw who were the wives and daughters of heroes, for before that the divine night would give out. And now Odysseus is done with his story, and he's speaking to the Phaeacians. It is time now for my sleep, either joining my companions on board the fast ship or here, but you and the gods will see to my homeward journey. So he spoke, and all of them, the Phaeacians, stayed stricken to silence, held in thrall by the story all through the shadowy chambers. Now it was white-armed Arete who began the discourse. Phaeacians, what do you think now of this man before you for beauty and stature, and for the mind well balanced within him? And again, he is my own guest, but each one of you has some part in honoring him. Do not hurry to send him off, nor cut short his gifts when he is in such need, for you all have many possessions, by the grace of the gods, stored up in your palaces. Then in turn the aged hero Echeneus spoke forth, who was the most advanced in age of all the Phaeacians. Friends, our circumspect queen is not off the mark in her speaking, nor short of what we expect of her. Do then as she tells us. From now on, the word and the act belong to Alcinous. Then in turn, Alcinous spoke to him and answered, even so this word will be mine to say, as long as I am alive and king over the oar-loving Phaeacians. But let our guest, line 350, much though he longs for the homeward journey, still endure to wait till tomorrow, until I have raised all the contribution. But the men shall see to his convoy home, and I most of all, for mine is the power in this district. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered him, line 355, O great Alcinous, preeminent among all people, if you urged me to stay here even for the length of a year, and still sped my conveyance home and gave me glorious presents, that would be what I wished. There would be much advantage in coming back with a fuller hand to my own dear country, and I would be more respected so, and be more popular with all people who saw me, with all the people who saw me make my return to Ithaca. So Odysseus doesn't mind waiting one more night, especially if it means more booty. Then Alcinous answered him in turn and said to him, Odysseus, We, as we look upon you, do not imagine that you are a deceptive or thievish man, the sort that the black earth breeds in great numbers, people who wander widely making up lying stories from which no one could learn anything. You have a grace upon your words, and there is sound sense within them, and expertly, as a singer would do, you have told the story of the dismal sorrows befallen yourself and all the Argives. But come now, tell me this, and give me an accurate answer. Did you see any of your godlike companions who once with you went to Ilion and there met their destiny? Here is a night that is very long. It is endless. It is not time yet to sleep in the palace. But go on, telling your wonderful story. I myself could hold out until the bright dawn, if only you could bear to tell me, here in the palace, of your sufferings. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered him, O great Alcinous, preeminent among all people, there is a time for many words and a time for sleeping. But if you insist on hearing me still, I would not begrudge you the tale of these happenings and others yet more pitiful to hear, the sorrows of my companions who perished later, who escaped onslaught and cry of battle, but perished all for the sake of a vile woman on a homeward journey. And of course, this vile woman is most likely Helen. And here in line 385, Odysseus picks up his story again. The Phaeacians have said they'll listen all night, and he is willing. And in 385, he picks up his story again. Now, when chaste Persephone had scattered the female souls of the women, driving them off in every direction, there came the soul of Agamemnon, the son of Atreus, grieving, and the souls of the other men who died with him and met their doom in the house of Aegisthus were gathered around him. The listener will remember that Aegisthus is Agamemnon's cousin. He is the cousin who was mentioned back in Book 1 at line 35, and he is the cousin from our recent 30 or 45 minute session on the curse on the house of Atreus. This is that Aegisthus, the cousin of Agamemnon. Line 390. He knew me at once when he drank the dark blood and fell to lamentation loud and shrill, and the tears came springing and threw himself into my arms, meaning so to embrace me. But there was no force there any longer, nor any juice left now in his flexible limbs, as there had been in time past. I broke into tears at the sight of him, and my heart pitied him. And so I spoke aloud to him and addressed him in winged words, Son of Atreus, most lordly and king of men, Agamemnon, what doom of death that lays men low has been your undoing? Was it with the ships? And did Poseidon, rousing a storm blast of battering winds that none would wish for, prove your undoing? Or was it on the dry land? Did men embattled destroy you as you tried to cut out cattle and fleecy sheep from their holdings? Or fighting against them for the sake of their city and women? So here Odysseus looks at Agamemnon and says, Oh my goodness, were you battling or stealing or grabbing women? How was it you were undone? So I spoke, and he in turn said to me in answer, line 405, Son of Laertes and seat of Zeus, resourceful Odysseus, not in the ships, nor did Poseidon, rousing a storm blast of battering winds that none would wish for, prove my destruction. Nor on dry land did enemy men destroy me in battle. Aegisthus, my cousin, working out my death and destruction, invited me to his house and feasted me and killed me there with the help of my sluttish wife, as one cuts down an ox at his manger. We will be reading this story in its entirety when we read Aeschylus's tragedies, the Oresteia. These are written in the 450s BC, and you'll be familiar with all of these stories when we read those, so hang on to this. Line 412. So I died a most pitiful death, and my other companions were killed around me without mercy, like pigs with shining tusks, in the house of a man rich and very powerful, for a wedding or a festival or a communal dinner. You have been present in your time at the slaughter of many men, killed singly or in the strong encounters of battle, but beyond all others you would have been sorry at heart for this scene, how we lay sprawled by the mixing bowl and the loaded tables all over the palace, and the whole floor was steaming with blood. And most pitiful was the voice I heard of Priam's daughter Cassandra, killed by treacherous Clytemnestra over me. But I lifted my hands and with them beat on the ground as I died upon the sword. But the sluttish woman turned away from me and was so hard that her hands would not press shut my eyes and mouth, though I was going to Hades. So Agamemnon has told Odysseus here, you wouldn't believe how I died at home by the hand of my wife. In the Oresti, when we read Agamemnon, he actually dies in the bathtub. And of course, there are a million different versions. But the thing to do, line 426 here, when someone dies, this is no different than what we would do today. When someone passes away, you close their eyes and their mouth. It's a decent thing to do. And he's telling Odysseus here in line 426, book 11, that she didn't even do that. So there is nothing more deadly or more vile than a woman who stores her mind with acts that are of such sort as this one did when she thought of this act of dishonor and plotted the murder of her lawful husband. And here is an excursion again. You must realize that Odysseus has to realize, oh my goodness, the gods are with me. I know what's going on at home. I know my wife has been true to me. Poor Agamemnon didn't have any of these advantages. And but for the grace of the gods, so to speak, Odysseus could have found himself in the same situation, surprising the suitors, and they would just kill him. Back to line 430. See, I had been thinking that I would be welcome to my children and thralls of my household when I came home, but she, with thoughts surpassingly grisly, splashed the shame on herself and the rest of her sex, on women still to come, even on the one whose acts are virtuous. Poor Agamemnon thought his wife Clytemnestra would forget that he had sacrificed their daughter Iphigenia to get fair winds to sail for Troy. Line 435. So he spoke, and I again said to him in answer, shame it is, how most terribly Zeus of the wide brows from the beginning has been hateful to the seed of Atreus through the schemes of women. Many of us died for the sake of Helen, and when you were far, Clytemnestra plotted treason against you. Line 440. So I spoke, and he in turn said to me in answer, so by this, do not be too easy even with your wife, nor give her an entire account of all you are sure of. Tell her part of it, but let the rest be hidden in silence. And yet you, Odysseus, will never be murdered by your wife. The daughter of Icarius, circumspect Penelope, is all too virtuous, and her mind is stored with good thoughts. Ah, well, she was only a young wife when we left her and went off to the fighting, and she had an infant child then at the breast. That child must now sit with the men and be counted. Happy he, for his dear father will come back and see him, and he will fold his father in his arms as is right. My wife never even let me feed my eyes with the sight of my own son, but before that I myself was killed by her. And put away in your heart this other thing that I tell you. Line 455. When you bring your ship in to your own dear country, do it secretly, not in the open. There is no trusting in women. But come now, tell me this and give me an accurate answer. Tell me if you happened to hear that my own son was still living, his son Agamemnon's son Orestes, whether perhaps in Orchomenus or in sandy Pylos, or perhaps with Menelaus in wide Sparta, for nowhere upon the earth has there been any death of noble Orestes. So he spoke, and I again said to him in answer, son of Atreus, why do you ask me that? I do not know if he is alive or dead. It is bad to babble emptily. Line 465. So we two stood there exchanging our sad words, grieving both together and shedding the big tears. After this, there came to us the soul of Peleus's son Achilles, and the soul of Patroclus, and the soul of stately Antilochus, and the soul of Aias, who for beauty and stature was greatest of all the Danaans next to the stately son of Peleus. The soul of swift-footed Achilles, Scion of Iacus, knew me, and full of lamentation he spoke to me in winged words. Here we have Achilles speaking to Odysseus. Son of Laertes and seed of Zeus, resourceful Odysseus, hard man, What made you think of this bigger endeavor? How could you endure to come down here to Hades' place where the senseless dead men dwell, mere imitations of perished mortals? So he spoke, and I again said to him in answer, Son of Peleus, far the greatest of the Achaeans, Achilles, I came for the need to consult Tiresias if he might tell me some plan by which I might come back to rocky Ithaca, for I have not yet been near Achaean country, nor ever set foot on my land, but always I have troubles. Achilles, no man before has been more blessed than you, nor ever will be. Before, when you were alive, we Argives honored you as we did the gods, and now in this place you have great authority over the dead. Do not grieve, even in death, Achilles. So apparently Achilles has some place of honor here among the dead. Of course, they're all senseless, so I don't know what good it does, unless they get a blood offering. So I spoke, and he in turn said to me in answer, Oh, shining Odysseus, never try to console me for dying. I would rather follow the plow as thrall to another man, one with no land allotted him and not much to live on, than to be a king over all the perished dead. But come now, tell me anything you have heard of my proud son, whether or not he went along to war to fight as a champion, and tell me anything you have heard about stately Peleus, my father, whether he still keeps his position among the Myrmidon hordes, or whether in Hellas and Pythia they have diminished his state, because old age constrains his hands and feet, and I am no longer there under the light of the sun to help him. Not the man I used to be once, when in the wide Troad I killed the best of their people, fighting for the Argives. If only for a little while I could come like that to the house of my father, my force and my invincible hands would terrify such men as use force on him and keep him away from his rightful honors. So he spoke, and I again said to him in answer, Line 505, I have no report to give you of stately Peleus, but as for your beloved son Neoptolemus, I will tell you, since you ask me to do it, all the true story, for I myself, in the hollow hull of a balanced ship, brought him over from Scyros to join the strong grieved Achaeans. Whenever we, around the city of Troy, talked over our counsels, he would always speak first, and never blunder. In speaking, only godlike Nestor and I were better than he was. And when we Achaeans fought in the Trojan plain, he never would hang back where there were plenty of other men, nor stay with the masses, but run far out in front, giving way to no man for fury. And many were those he killed in the terrible fighting. I could not tell over the number of all, nor name all the people he killed as he fought for the Argives. But what a great man was one! The son of Telephus he slew with the brazen spear, the hero Eurypylus, and many Cittian companions were killed about him, by reason of womanish presence. Next to great Memnon, this was the finest man I ever saw. Again, when we who were the best of the Argives entered the horse that Epeus made, this is the Trojan horse, and all the command was given to me to keep close hidden inside or sally out from it. The other leaders of the Danaans and men of council were wiping their tears away, and the limbs were shaking under each man of them, but never at any time did I see him losing his handsome color and going pale, or wiping the tears off his face, but rather he implored me to let him sally out of the horse. He kept feeling for his sword hilt and spear weighted with bronze, full of evil thoughts for the Trojans. But after we had sacked the sheer citadel of Priam, with his fair share and a princely prize of his own, he boarded his ship unscathed. Line 535. He had not been hit by thrown and piercing bronze, nor stabbed in close-up combat, as often happens in fighting. The war god rages at all and favors no man. So I spoke, and the soul of the swift-footed Scion of Iacus stalked away in long strides across the meadow of Asphodel. And of course, this meadow is just a place down in the underworld, and it's a terrible, dreary meadow. Happy for what I had said of his son, and how he was famous. Now, the rest of the souls of the perished dead stood near me grieving, and each one spoke to me and told of his sorrows. Only the soul of Telamonian Aias stood off at a distance from me, angry still over that decision I won against him, when beside the ships we disputed our cases for the arms of Achilles. His queenly mother set them as prize, and the sons of the Trojans with Pallas Athena judged. And I wish I had never won in a contest like this, so high a head has gone under the ground for the sake of that armor. Aias, line 550, who for beauty and for achievement surpassed all the Danaans next to the stately son of Peleus. And of course Odysseus is remembering here, after the death of Achilles, we had the beautiful armor that Hephaestus had made him to fight and die in, and this armor had to be given to someone. And the Trojans, the contest was between Odysseus and Aias. Telamonian Aias, and Odysseus got it. And Aias still has not forgiven him for that. So I spoke to him now in words of conciliation. Aias, son of stately Telamon, could you then never even in death forget your anger against me because of that cursed armor? The gods made it to pain the Achaeans, so great a bulwark were you who were lost to them. We Achaeans grieved for your death as incessantly as for Achilles, the son of Peleus, at his death, and there is no other to blame but Zeus. He, in his terrible hate for the army of Danaan spearmen, visited this destruction upon you. Come nearer, my lord, so you can hear what I say and listen to my story. Suppress your anger and lordly spirit. And should you read the Greek tragedy Ajax, you will hear the story that Aias, or Ajax, was so humiliated at the loss of this armor that he was not awarded the armor, and Odysseus was, that he went out and went mad and tried to kill all his men, killed a bunch of sheep instead, and then committed suicide out on the beach. So I spoke. He gave no answer, but went off after the other souls of the perished dead men into the darkness. Line 565. There, despite his anger, he might have spoken, or I might have spoken to him, but the heart in my inward breast wanted still to see the souls of the other perished dead men. There I saw Minos, the glorious son of Zeus, seated, holding a golden scepter and issuing judgments among the dead, who, all around the great lord, argued their cases, some sitting and some standing, by the wide-gated house of Hades. After him I was aware of gigantic Orion in the meadow of Asphodel, rounding up and driving together wild animals he himself had killed in the lonely mountains, holding in his hands a brazen club forever unbroken. And I saw Tityus, Earth's glorious son, lying in the plain and sprawled over 9 acres. Two vultures, sitting one on either side, were tearing his liver, plunging inside the caul. With his hands he could not beat them away. He had manhandled Leto, the honored consort of Zeus, as she went through spacious Panopeus toward Pytho. And I saw Tantalus also, suffering hard pains, standing in lake water that came up to his chin, and thirsty as he was, he tried to drink, but could capture nothing, for every time the old man, trying to drink, stooped over, the water would drain away and disappear, and the black earth showed at his feet, and the divinity dried it away. Over his head, trees with lofty branches had fruit like a shower descending, pear trees and pomegranate trees and apple trees with fruit shining, line 590, and figs that were sweet and olives ripened well. But each time the old man would straighten up and reach with his hands for them, the wind would toss them away toward the clouds overhanging. This, of course, is the Tantalus who fathered Pelops. He is the Tantalus who chopped up Pelops, served him to the gods to see if they would know. Persephone accidentally ate his shoulder before she realized what it was. The gods put Pelops back together. He became the charioteer of Poseidon, and so he's a very good charioteer. And then Pelops went off and got the Peloponnese named after him. He fathered the sons Atreus and Thyestes, and Thyestes then is the father of Aegisthus, and Atreus is the father of Agamemnon and Menelaus. And that's why when Aegisthus kills Agamemnon, he is killing his cousin. And that is the 4 generations out of the 5. Of course, the last is Agamemnon's son Orestes, of the curse on the house of Orestes. Back to the text, line 593. Also, I saw Sisyphus. He was suffering strong pains, and with both arms embracing the monstrous stone, struggling with hands and feet alike, he would try to push the stone upward to the crest of the hill, that when it was on the point of going over the top, the force of gravity turned it backwards, and the pitiless stone rolled back down to the level. He then tried once more to push it up, straining hard, and sweat ran down all down his body, line 600, and over his head a cloud of dust rose. After him, I was aware of powerful Heracles. His image, that is, but he himself among the immortal gods enjoys their festivals, married to sweet-stepping Hebe, the child of great Zeus and Hera of the golden sandals. Here we find out that Heracles, you remember that Heracles was made immortal, and he's married to Hebe, the cup-bearer. So here in Hades is only the image of Heracles. Line 605. All around him was a clamor of the dead, as of birds scattering sacred in every direction. But he came on like dark night, holding his bow bare with an arrow laid on the bowstring, and forever looking as one who shot with terrible glances. There was a terrible belt crossed over his chest, and a golden baldric with marvelous works of art that figured upon it, bears and lions with glaring eyes, and boars of the forests, the battles and the quarrels, the murders and the manslaughters. May he who artfully designed them, and artfully put them upon that baldric, never again do any designing. Line 615. He recognized me at once as soon as his eyes had seen me, and full of lamentation he spoke to me in winged words. So this is Heracles speaking to Odysseus. Son of Laertes and seed of Zeus, resourceful Odysseus, unhappy man, are you too leading some wretched destiny such as I too pursued when I went still in the sunlight? For I was son of Cronion Zeus, but I had an endless spell of misery. I was made bondman to one who was far worse than I, and he loaded my difficult labors on me. One time he sent me here to fetch the dog back, remember, Cerberus, and thought there could be no other labor to be devised more difficult than that one. But I brought the dog up and led him from the realm of Hades, and Hermes saw me on my way with Pallas Athena. So he spoke and went back into the realm of Hades. And of course Heracles has been speaking about his 12 labors. And so he's finished talking, and he goes back into Hades. But I stayed fast in place where I was, to see if some other one of the generation of heroes who died before me would come. And I might have seen men earlier still, whom I wanted to see, Pirithous and Theseus, God's glorious children. But before that, the hordes of the dead men gathered about me with inhuman clamor, and green fear took hold of me with the thought that proud Persephone might send up against me some gorgonish head of a terrible monster up out of Hades. So, going back on board my ship, I told my companions also to go aboard and to cast off the stern cables, and quickly they went aboard the ship and sat to the oarlocks, and the swell of the current carried her down the ocean river with rowing at first, line 640, but after that on a fair wind following. And here we end with Odysseus still sitting up during the night with the Phaeacians, telling them his story, and they are rapt and attentive. And thus ends book 11.